When you're with a patient, of course, you take all that you know in your head or all the theory and you throw it away. I mean, otherwise, you know, you have to listen to the patient. And then maybe afterwards, or something becomes clear. And you use that in between as a way, maybe, hopefully, use it maybe in the next session or sessions after. But if you were sitting there and thinking, okay, now the patient is in the paranoid schizoid position, or now he's in the real, or, I mean, that would be disastrous, I think. You got to listen with your guts, with your emotions, with your intellect, all of it, with your body, in order to understand what's going on in a particular moment, in a particular session. And then later on, I think you might be able to make sense of it through theory and through supervision.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Jean-Wolf Bernstein. Dr. Wolf Bernstein is a psychoanalyst who is currently living and working in Vienna, Austria. She did, however, receive her psychoanalytic training and for many years practiced in Berkeley, California. And that's the focus of our conversation, what she, by virtue of these bicultural experiences, has been able to discern about how culture influences one's thinking, and especially the role of language in representing one's internal processes. And we also touch on the importance that Freud discovered the unconscious through his German language, and we get into that in some detail. Dr. Wolf Bernstein is a member and training analyst at the Vienna Working Group for Psychoanalysis, where she's also on the board. She's also the head of the Scientific Advisory Council of the Vienna Sigmund Freud Museum, where she had also been the Fulbright Freud Visiting Scholar in Psychoanalysis in 2008. As I mentioned, prior to moving to Vienna, she was a past president and supervising and personal analyst at the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California, known as PINC. She's still on the faculty at PINC and also at the NYU postdoctoral program. She is very widely published. Her most recent publications, and these are just chapters in many different books. One is called Beyond the Bedrock. One is called The Space of Transition Between Winnicott and Lacan. There's a section on Lacan in the textbook of psychoanalysis. The paper we focus on today is called Living Between Two Languages, A Bifocal Perspective. That's a book from a book called Immigration in Psychoanalysis. There's a chapter on Dora, the unending and unraveling story. There's a chapter entitled Unexpected Antecedents to the Concept of the Death Drive, A Return to the Beginnings. And her new book on Edouard Manet is Framing the Past and the Gaze, which is forthcoming. We have a wide-ranging, delightful conversation about many facets of psychoanalytic practice. And as I say, the use of language and how it informs when she lives and has lived both inside the German language and also inside the English language, putting her in a position to reflect on the meanings and expressions and communications of each of them. It's quite lively, and I learned a great deal. I hope you enjoy it as I do. Jean, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad to have you here.
Hello.
I'd like to read a sentence from a paper you've written, and the paper is Living Between Languages, a Bifocal Perspective. And in this paper, you quote the writer and translator Arthur Goldschmidt, who says, quote, Freud could never have discovered the unconscious without the syllable ver, V-E-R. To repeat it, Freud could never have discovered the unconscious without the syllable ver. And when I read that, I was startled for a number of reasons. One, it's such an absolutist statement. Startled me. It seemed to reduce something far more complicated into something very simple. And especially since I don't know about the syllable there, I was doubly interested in it. And you and I are going to spend some time on the presence of language as a piece of our minds and how it lives in individuals and in the analytic setting. But I want to put that aside for just a moment. As you know, and as the listeners know, the power of culture to influence our inner lives, and through that, to influence the analytic process, is a very alive notion right now in our field. And many of us have had the experience of working with people who come from different ethnic and racial backgrounds from ourselves, different socioeconomic classes, different educational experiences, different mother tongues, and different political orientations. There's a real difference in manifest histories with many patients that we see. And it has always struck me that one of the privileges of being an analyst is it gives us an opportunity to try to get inside the inner life of people who on the surface are so different than we are. And one of the things we discover when we do that is that often cultural manifestations become revealed as disguises, screens, if you will, for intrapsychic conflicts. And we also discover that intrapsychic internal matters can also distract us from appreciating cultural differences. And for me, that's sort of the fun of the work, is to make one's way through that, both within myself and collaboratively with the analyst and. But it also is worth noting that even when people are ostensibly very similar to us in all the obvious demographic characteristics, in some ways the work is more challenging then because it's easy to be seduced into assuming similarity because we went to a similar type university, for example. And we may be tempted to take the easy way out and not really examine the assumptions we have about, well, what did that experience mean to this person as opposed to what it meant to me? But as we make our way through this interesting morass of ideas, Jean, you've presented us and you with what the scientists call a natural experiment. You're one analyst who functioned and worked as an analyst in Berkeley, California, and now you work as an analyst in Vienna, Austria. And so you've eliminated one variable, the variable of, well, this analyst treated someone from Berkeley and that analyst treated someone from Vienna, and we can have a conversation about the similarities and differences, but the variable of the different analyst is a considerable obstacle for real clarity. But you've solved that as best as it could be solved. And we're going to learn from you about what there is to learn about working in two significantly different cultures. But before we get to that, tell us about your journey. What brought you from Germany to Berkeley? How your life there formed, becoming an analyst? Let us get to know that part of you.
Okay. I came to Berkeley actually with the idea of maybe just staying for a year, just to sort of, I wanted to get to know the United States. I had heard that California was a great place to be. And I actually came not exactly from Germany, but I had worked for 2 years at a private bilingual school, but not bilingual in German and English, but bilingual in French and English. And so I was told by a French instructor that the schools in America that teach bilingualism are far more advanced than the ones in France. So I chose a school in in Berkeley and a public school called the Martin Luther King Junior High School. And that's where I stayed for a year, trying to teach French to young kids in Berkeley. And you know, that was sufficiently fun and pleasant. But then I wanted to pursue what had been my initial plan, is to study psychology. So I, after some detours, I ended up at UC Berkeley and received my BA at UC Berkeley. And then a few years later, realizing that I wasn't able to do a thing with a BA, I pursued some studies or my PhD at the Wright Institute, which is a small school, but was known for its sort of emphasis on Marxism and psychoanalysis. Had also maybe some connection with Theodor Adorno. So there was, again, you know, the different languages. And got my PhD there a few years later. And once I had accomplished all that, I just sort of, it didn't seem possible, or even I couldn't think that would be the end of my staying in the States. And so I ended up staying in the United States. What had been, at least had been at the beginning, just a sort of fluky, flimsy maybe plan to just, you know, explore California, turned into that little adventure turned into actually staying in Berkeley for 37 years. And then there came the time to think about, there were certain desires to maybe go back to Europe and to see whether actually having become so Americanized in the eyes of my family in Europe, who had all stayed in Europe, to see whether I would be able to still live in Europe, which had a very different life than the United States. So
let me interrupt you before you return to Europe. Let's spend some time in Berkeley. You write in your paper that you realized, perhaps in retrospect, that you're coming to the States. You write, identified you with the very people who had to flee Germany. And then that played an influence. Can you say something about that?
Yeah. I mean, again, that was not, that was absolutely not a conscious thought when I left for Berkeley. I mean, I was sort of maybe a little innocent and maybe a little naive to do it. But I have to say, in my life, sometimes these innocent and naive moments led to the biggest changes and steps in my life. I just did it, not to think much about what it would entail. And then I realized over the years that maybe unconsciously I was driven nachträglich, après coup, retroactively by something that weighed, of course, heavily on my psyche, of maybe identifying with the very people, the Jews that the Nazis had either driven out of Germany and, of course, Austria, or had, you know, killed in massive or attempted to extinguish during the Shoah or the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. And that very subject, of course, became a very important subject throughout my career as an analyst, mostly in my writing, but also in some of the analyses I treated.
And the analyses, meaning that the people you treated were descendants of either survivors or perpetrators, is that what you mean?
Some of them were. Uh-huh. Some of them were, and of course there was a question about, you know, where was my history, you know, where was I coming from? Obviously, I had an accent in English, so was I German? Was I Jewish? All of these things without necessarily being answered, but they became very, very important subjects of conversation, as maybe Adam Phillips would say, within the analysis.
You know, it's an interesting thing. It's not necessarily that they were answered. Of course, it is not unusual for when personal questions are asked of us that we don't simply take them as manifest questions and answers, but we do what we can to find the meaning to the patient of them. And just as you recounted what you just said about it's not necessarily answered, I had a gut reaction, which is, well, how could you not answer that? How is that not in a different category from the usual questions that are personal questions? Now, I don't know what to do with that. That was just my gut reaction to it. But did it feel that way to you in any way as well, that it felt like that large a question, that large a reality question, lives in a different category than the usual deflection of personal questions?
Such as, you know, are you married, do you have children,
etc. Yeah, the usual things, right.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's, I mean, I think that there is a lot to be said about that, about the whole question of abstinence anyway. You know, to what extent I think now, sometimes we in psychoanalysis, I think, fetishize this whole question of abstinence and neutrality. And I was always convinced, for instance, that this was not Freud's doing, but that is what we made of Freud thereafter. Because from what I could gather from Freud's own cases, he wasn't very abstinent or very neutral. It's what I think primarily American psychoanalysis made of Freud. But that withstanding, yes, eventually I would say that to patients, but not right away. I didn't want to tease them with not telling them. Right. But at the same time, because it was such an important question, who were they seeing, you know? I took quite a bit of time to really explore it without what I sometimes think is sort of gratuitous pleasure that we're the ones not telling them, because we have this sort of theoretical paradigm of neutrality and abstinence, but also not immediately telling them for sometimes I think not just with the question, am I Jewish, am I not Jewish, am I, but with other answers as well, I think sometimes a too quick response to that also loses some of the material we otherwise could really explore and use. So I think it was a very, I think I treaded carefully knowing what was at stake.
Something I say is that when asked certain questions, I would say, I'm fine to answer the question, but how about if we get to know more about it along the way?
Something and like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I would put it so pithily as you just did. I probably was, you know, a little bit more vague. But yeah, exactly. You know, not to. I think so much about this whole question of counter-transference, you know, which has become such a huge subject in our field that. I think there's more to psychoanalysis, but how can I put it? I think it's a worthwhile question, but it can also be used by the old tradition of analysts as a sort of, as a teaser. You know, I'm not going to tell you anything.
Right, right.
And that's what I call the fetishization of secrecy, of, you know, what I'm about. And yet at the same time, it's also not a solution to become sort of, as one analyst friend of mine said, to become chummy with your patient.
Then you deprive them of a certain kind of experience.
Between those two poles.
Right. I can't help but be reminded of a conversation I had with an analyst in Poland a few months ago. And she was talking about what it's like to live in Poland, to travel the streets that used to be filled with Jewish communities. And she told a story that she heard from a colleague of hers, that the colleague was treating a Jewish analyst. And the analyst asked her analyst, in a sense, the obvious question, which is, would you have hidden me had I come to your home? And just to be real clear very quickly, the person I was interviewing was never told the answer that the analyst gave, and I don't know it. It sort of invites you to say, and what did she say? And what did she say? And I don't know what she said. And she didn't know what she said. But it's one of those, it's not like the question of, you know, are you married and how many kids do you have?
Right. Right.
But let's talk about analysis in Berkeley. What was it like for you? And was it what you expected? What you felt about your training? How the whole experience went for you? And then also about what your practice was while you were there.
You mean my analytic training? Is that what
Yes.
you
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay. So I think, again, retroactively, I was incredibly lucky. But I didn't know it at the time, as in so many instances, I think, in my life. I was, at the time when I finished my PhD, which was in 1985, at that point, because I just had, just in parentheses, I had a PhD, I was not able to do a full analytic training, because at that time it was still the law or the rule that you could only practice or train to become an analyst if you had a medical degree. So the only thing I could have done at the time was conducting a research analysis, and I really didn't want to do that. It was sort of this in-between construct that made no sense to me. The thing I was lucky about is that in 1989, as you know, this big lawsuit was won, so that they settled out of court, so that the American Psychoanalytic Association was able to admit candidates that were not just MDs but also PhDs and LCSWs. And some institutes were granted to be established, such as the institute I was at, the Psychoanalytic Institute of Northern California, shortly said PINC. It was one of the first known few new institutes where people like me could apply. And that's what I did. And I was sort of involved in the beginning in the formation and the establishment of this institute. And then I applied as a candidate a few years later. And I'm very glad about the training I got at PINC. Maybe at that time, of course, I had to, critique this, that, da 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 da. But in retrospect,
that's the job of a candidate for sure.
Right, exactly. Right. But in retrospect, the way that we train people was fabulous, and it has something to do with the topic of our conversation also today, that we really were trained and held to the idea, maybe not ideal, but idea that we had to learn all the different language in psychoanalysis so that we wouldn't just become Freudians or Bayonians or Kleinians or what have you, but really step by step every year learn the different languages. And this was very important for me and very important for my future. I mean, my, by now past, but then future professional life. To know them all and to choose between, or not to identify just as a Kleinian or just as a Winnicottian or just as a Lacanian, but really find a way between them. And that's how I've always practiced psychoanalysis, and that's how I taught psychoanalysis. Mm. This one concept, and Winnicott would say this about that, and Lacan would say this about that, and be on this. And PINC really gave me that opportunity to be able to do that.
Did you find, or how did you find the multiplicity of theories, having a presence or not in the clinical moment? I say that because I've been on various committees where people identify themselves through these various backgrounds. But when you listen to clinical material, a real process material, you couldn't tell who was a Lacanian and who was a Kleinian and who was an object relation in eco-psychology. We would be most often in synchrony about, well, I might not have said that comment quite like that, but if I follow the patient's associations, it seemed to deepen their experience of themselves and the treatment. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to make the leap to say, and therefore theory only can get in the way, but what about how theory can get in the way?
Do you remember Erwin Hoffman?
Sure.
Right. He was one of my teachers at PINC, and he said a few very memorable things and also told me a wonderful joke, but
Wait a second. You're going to have to share the joke with us, too.
The joke is one of my favorite jokes. Do you want to hear the joke first?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, well, now that you brought it up, you have to.
He told the joke about, and I think it was him, a greeting. He got the referral of a new patient, and he goes into the waiting room, and there's this, tall, good-looking, man, in a white suit and hat and just perfectly dressed. And there's Erwin Hoffman. I mean, he's small, a bit schlumpy, long mm-hmm. hair, and, not at all the sort of maybe ideal of beauty. And apparently what he did is he shook hands with the patient and said, "Shall we try anyway?"
That's lovely. That's great. That's great.
But the other thing he said, in back to theory, is that when you're with a patient, of course you take all that in your head, or all the theory, and you throw it away. I mean, otherwise, you have to listen to the patient, and then maybe afterwards, or something becomes clear. And you use that in between as a way, maybe, hopefully, use it maybe in the next session or sessions after. But if you were sitting there and thinking, okay, now the patient is in the paranoid schizoid position, or now he's in the real, that would be disastrous, I think. You got to listen with your guts, with your emotions, with your intellect, all of it, with your body, in order to understand what's going on in a particular moment, in a particular session. And then later on, I think you might be able to make sense of it through theory and through supervision.
Hmm. I'm glad you put it as clearly as you just did, because especially for trainees, as they are bombarded with theory and they don't trust, reasonably enough, their guts and their body to really inform them with any dependability on what's happening in the patient and between them, that there's an over-reliance on intellectualized concepts. And you've mm-hmm. just laid out a pathway that's very clear. Mm-hmm. So your practice in Berkeley was what kind of patient, if you could generalize?
I think at some point, I would say young, mostly youngish, younger women and some men. I remember there was a moment I thought, God, I'm only seeing women. What's that? Why don't I get, more experience with male patients, especially at that time? You know, there was when we went through our training, we had, I don't think the IPA requests that anymore, but back then they did, that one of our control cases was a male patient.
Yes.
And I had a bit of a trouble to have a male patient, but eventually I did. And then the minute I thought about it, I thought, this is sort of an odd thing. You know, what is it about? Why are so many male patients going to male analysts and female patients to mostly also male analysts and some female? It shifted. So it was, given that it was Berkeley, of course, quite a few academics, quite a few graduate students, quite a few teachers from the university. And then later on, as I became a training analyst, of course, I did some training analyses.
All right, let's take that experience, and you're now in Vienna. Okay. And to go back to your paper, you again quote Goldschmidt, and he says, each language to speak. He says, I observe what I can do in each language, and see what it allows me to do and what affect and effect it produces in me in turn. Meaning, as I understand it, that each language reveals something unique about people, the world, what it allows us to see and what it obscures for us. And it would seem to me then that in addition to the cultural shift that you experienced, your analyses in the States were, I presume, in English, and your analyses in Vienna are now in German. And just that, I'm imagining, I'm about to ask you to elaborate, just that is a different experience for both parties. How accurate is that?
Well, two things. Not all the analyses in Berkeley were in English. Some were in French, never interesting enough in German. I don't think, except for one, I didn't do a single analysis in German. When I came to Vienna, something funny happened because it took me some time, even though German was my maternal language, I sounded funny to the people here. For one, I was German, and arriving in Austria, which is sort of for them, I'm German, which is much right. bigger foreigner, than being American. So by the way I speak, they immediately identify me as German.
Let me just ask you what you just said, if I heard that right. Did you say to a Viennese, you are more foreign as a German than you are as an American?
Yes, I'm putting in parentheses the narcissism of small differences.
A lot of resentments between
the Austrians and the Germans. I mean, there's small mm-hmm. differences, and one as an outsider wouldn't really hear this, but mm-hmm. in terms of the dialect and what they hear, I'm immediately identified as not being Austrian. So that was mm-hmm. one thing. The other thing was, and that took some time, is that that the way I phrased sentences was still really influenced by the English structure. So even though I know German, but structurally I sounded different to them. So I began to teach in Vienna fairly quickly, and I was told 2 years later that one of the people said, "Why did they hire this Jeanne-Wolf Bernstein? She seems to come from Australia." Because it was like they didn't know what to do with me in a way. Yeah. Yeah. But that sort of, you know, over the years, of course, I've got more into sync that, you know, I don't sound funny anymore. And, you know, but it's a very interesting tension between having spoken and having lived in the English language and then transferring this back into my maternal language. That took some time. And I have to say, there is also that sort of disjunction that I also felt. I couldn't find words. I sort of, I miss it. You know, because it really, that these first 2 or 3 years until I'm now mostly back into German and love it when I have an opportunity to speak English, that disjunction, internal disjunction I felt, really gave me the opportunity, and this is what I'm saying in this paper, that I could be a foreigner in my own language and could listen to the language I grew up with a foreign ear. That was amazing. I wish I could have maintained it, but I can't, because after a certain period of time, you only hear German, you only listen to German, and you're sort of in it again, but you lose that edge of listen to the various words that you sort of commonly use with a foreign ear.
You describe teaching at both institutes in the States and in Vienna. Is there an overarching difference that you could identify in either what is taught, how it is taught, or to whom it is taught, how it is received? Are they interchangeable experiences, or are they really quite distinct?
I would say they're more different. They're more discernible differences. First of all, the training here is far more formal. There would be absolutely no, I don't think any of my students called me by my first name. That is just unthinkable.
Mm-hmm.
Just a small thing. It's much more formal. It's much more authoritarian. And the students tend to be much more silent, be much more, submissive in a way. So what I ended up doing in the beginning, I said, you know what? I speak, but I'm American. And so I Americanized them. So I told them, I said, you know, you can interrupt me. You can, during the lecture, you can ask me questions. It's totally allowed. You don't have to wait till the end. And then maybe hesitantly ask me one question or another, which after a few years, once I sort of got them to sort of loosen up and to feel free to have a discussion, rather than expecting to just be lectured at by me, sometimes I couldn't get a word in at the end. But this is sort of, you know, the path it took. So yes, it's much more, the style is much more, there is the teacher, he or she has the knowledge that's being descended to us, and then we hesitantly ask maybe one or two questions. That's very much the style here. Huh. And so really it from my end, it needed a lot of loosening up to really, enter into a conversation.
Right. Now, that leads us to the question of how analysis lives and is practiced differently in the two settings, because what you're describing says that there must be some way that, you said, formal, authoritarian, submissive character are not manifestly, in any case, mm-hmm. not manifestly what you would associate with Berkeley young people. So mm-hmm. What was that like for you, the difference between being an analyst of both types of people, to use such a phrase?
Well, probably I brought a little bit of Europe to Berkeley.
Right.
And I brought a little Berkeley to Europe, I would say. You know, that sort of over informality of Berkeley, I just sort of think, that's a little bit going too far. So that sort of immediately thinking that they couldn't call me by my first name was very strange to me. Uh-huh. And I probably there, I reacted towards that. And then coming here, I was sort of put off by the utter formality and politeness and I'm now missing the word, sort of, shyness maybe, and modesty from the part of the students, but also at some level from the part of the patients. So I think that the warmth that I was used from my experience in California, the really getting to know and of the patient intimately, is something I think I carried over to Vienna, and that was probably initially startling to some of my patients here.
It would be the kind of thing I would imagine that candidates, to the extent that we're talking about candidates, they would speak to each other about, and they would say, she's different than so-and-so. Is that the sort of the scuttlebutt about you?
I think so. I wouldn't know, but I always make reference to that in the supervision sessions. And I say, you have to understand that I'm me. And yeah. I have a different training, and you probably hear so-and-so in your training, and you probably are more familiar with such and such, but this is what I do.
Are there differences in how boundaries are understood in the two settings?
Yeah.
How so?
Okay. Well, for instance, I was just thinking in terms of if somebody doesn't come to a session, or if somebody says, they want to end treatment suddenly, abruptly. I don't want to overgeneralize it,
sure.
but the idea that, that seems to me quite an acting out, and just accepting it and thinking you as an analyst can't react to this seems to me you're losing a chance. So at moments, I would say to them, well, why not write to them? Write a letter, not an email. Write a letter and see whether maybe you missed something that wasn't spoken about, and give them a chance again to come. That was news to them, absolutely novel to them.
I see.
Because there was a sense, okay, you don't run after a patient. You don't talk to them outside of sessions. All of these things were absolute no-nos. And, I think there to sort of, not overstepping the frame, but softening them, especially, I think with more traumatized people, it just, that's what I had learned, and that's what I sort of passed on to. to them.
And that's, I presume, what worked for you in your hands.
Yeah, I would think so.
Right. Now, we spoke about... No,
there's some patients, okay, they leave, and no matter what you do, they don't come back. But at least giving them that opportunity and not, I think, sometimes hide behind the frame.
Right.
But give them another chance. Yeah.
We spoke earlier about abstinence and various mm-hmm. expressions of it. Are there generalizations that you could make between the two cultures about how abstinence is understood and expressed?
I do think it's more formal here.
Mm-hmm.
It continues to be more formal than it is in the States. And I think that there's sort of a little bit cultural stereotypes that Austrian analysts also think, oh, these Americans, you know, they're too chummy and, you know, we don't do it as they do. And this has larger implications, too, if you think about the whole debate in the IPA, you know, between 3 and 4 and 5 sessions.
Right.
I think typically, historically, it's been always the Europeans who've sort of, you know, insisted on that it's not real analysis unless you come 4 or 5 times a week.
Right.
Whereas the rest of the world, South America, America, you know, has allowed 3 sessions to be efficient, or to sort of feel if there's an analytic process, it doesn't, you know, it can't be reduced to the number of sessions. But that's still a big divide, I think, Europe and the rest of the world.
Well, let me ask you a question. Since we're talking about your varied experiences and what we can learn from it, my impression from hearing you is that you have conducted analytic treatments at 3, 4, and 5 times a week, I'm assuming, and have you made any generalizations in your own mind about not whether it meets any criteria, because we're trying to be more clinically near, but about how effective 3 versus 4 or 5 times is?
To tell you the truth, I wished I could have done 5 times a week, maybe 1 or 2. But I've done a lot of 4 times a week analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and have the comparison to 3 times a week analysis. And I would say, personally, selfishly, I love to work as many times as, you know, a week as I can.
Mm-hmm.
I love the frequency of 4 times a week. But I'm also realistic enough that it's not possible for many patients. And if they come 3 times, you know, we make the best. And I wouldn't be able to say categorically that a 3 times analysis is less profound. Sometimes it takes longer. Not even that. And I also do see some people who can only come 2 times a week and they still use the couch.
Mm-hmm. I think that's common, actually.
Very unheard of here. You don't do that. If you see a patient 2 times a week, it means, and you see them at the couch, you can't do that because you're inviting a very regressive stance, and 2 times a week couldn't be tolerated. And that's not my experience. I think there are a few patients who really have the ability to draw as much out as possible out of each singles, and it works for them.
Yeah,
and if I see it doesn't, if really the sort of expected seems to appear, in other words, that they're overwhelmed and they can't bear, you know, waiting till the next session, then of course I speak to that.
That's one of the shibboleths that experience shows is not as universal as some people are comfortable assuming. I want to ask you one other question about the difference. You had mentioned this to me, and I was startled by this, and that is the concept of coverage. When you're away from the office for whatever reason, you told me that the notion of coverage is very different in the two countries. Can you share that with our listeners?
Yeah. When I lived in and worked in Berkeley, California, as you know, as your listeners know, if you go on vacation, you're obliged, you're obligated, both by your insurance and, well, not even by, I'm not sure, by the, your training institute, to find coverage to, for the time that you're gone. That is absolutely not the case here. In fact, when I suggested that maybe with a few patients to my students or my supervisees, that maybe they should find somebody since they take rather long vacations here, that's another difference to the United States. They should find somebody to cover for them. They didn't, it's sort of, I could have spoken Spanish or Chinese to them. It's just, you know, in that sense, absence is absence. We're not going to cover over it, but we acknowledge it that the analyst is gone for 4 to 6 weeks. And if there is an emergency, the general recommendation is that they need to go to a hospital or to some public agencies to seek help.
Now, let me ask you a question. Let me challenge myself or perhaps the two of us, because to me, what you said is outlandish. And maybe it's as outlandish as the notion of being on the couch twice a week is to the ordinary Viennese analyst. But you have a natural experiment again. So you're describing that your community does something that makes no sense to me, not to provide a name, especially for certain patients who are fragile, when one is away 4 to 6 weeks, using your example. Well, what has the data shown us? What is the experience with these patients and for these analysts when something outlandish is in fact put into practice?
Now, what is the outlandish? The outlandish.
Well, the outlandish that you don't provide coverage. I mean, in my professional life, for any physician, but for any clinician, it's part of one's clinical responsibility. It's as natural as the day is long. And that what is outlandish is the idea you say goodbye, again, especially for fragile patients, and you say nothing about if you need to be in touch with someone, here's someone who will be covering for me.
Well, you would say if you need coverage, you know where to go, to such and such an agency, or you can go to the psychiatric unit of such and such a hospital. That is understood in a way. It doesn't need a special reference.
But for me, I would want to make sure that I have the person of my choosing available to take care of this person, not go see an agency. I mean, to tell a patient, go see an agency, that's what's outlandish to me, as opposed to I've selected so-and-so who has agreed to be available to you as needed.
But I mean, on the other hand, you know, also to play the devil's advocate, on the other hand, it sometimes also can become quite outlandish if, as I sometimes had to do, you have three names back then on your on your answering machine. You have three names to cover you because nobody's there in August, right?
Right.
So you
right,
have,
yeah.
you know, mm-hmm. whatever, mayor, you know, who, and that becomes also ridiculous, I think. So I think working again between the two different cultures, between the two, ways of doing it, what I have ended up doing here is to say to my patients, if there is a, since I don't, you know, since people are really not used to being a cover for another therapist, I've said, if something comes up for you, then you can write me. And if we can find the time to do it, then, you know, we'll, we, so it stays with me. But it also gives a sense, you know, this that before we do that, it's not immediately available. But it stays with me and they can write me. And if you think that, if we feel that it's urgent enough, then of course I call them and figure out a way to talk to them. And that has worked really well.
I can imagine. That seems the best of all solutions than just even either giving out an agency's name or even a colleague's name.
Right. Because, I mean, the colleague's name is also fraught with difficulties.
Yes. Yes.
I think.
Let's return to the issue of language. And I want to repeat that sentence that I began with, that Arthur Goldschmidt said, Freud could have never discovered the unconscious without the syllable there. What does he mean by that?
Well, I the there, what does that mean? Right? It's really, you know, it's one of the things that are untranslatable. It's a structure within the German language. It's a sort of these three letters, V-E-R, that you can use very playfully with almost, with so many different verbs. And the only other languages I know are French and English, and you cannot do it in English, and you can do it in French. But there is a certain very consistent structure in German where you hang this three syllables in front of many verbs, and it changes it. So one of the things it does, I looked it up before we met today, so it what it does, it allows the verb that you're using to often express two exactly diametrical meanings. For instance, when Freud talks about faulty actions or slips of the tongue, right? He says that the patient will versprechen, so he misspeaks. Maybe in English. Misspeaks or mishears or mislooks. I mean, this would, you can't say it, but this would sort of be the literal thing. It often ends up having at least two different meanings. For instance, to mishearing, verhört sich in English, means he didn't listen to something. He listened, he heard one thing but understood another. But at the same time, it also means the German word Verhör means that it's an examination. So if you're in the police and the policeman questions you, you're in a Verhör. So it has both meanings at the same time. So it sort of injects so much playfulness in language. And I think this was really important for Freud. It allows you to mean two different things and sometimes diametrically opposed in the same word. He does it in the uncanny, right? That's where he goes into this one of the few essays. He really goes into the linguistics of what unheimlich means, because unheimlich has both. You're at home, heimlich, but unheimlich, so it's another one, makes it frightening. Yeah. So you play on the, or heimlich also means you do it secretively. That's the one. That's the equivoque. So heimlich means at home at one point, and means also secretively on another level. So this whole play between words and their multiplicity of meanings is, I think as Goldschmidt put it, you know, allowed Freud to really get into the depth of a language and bring all that sort of, he said, the verwirrende, the confusing, up to the top.
The way you write this in your paper, to quote it, you say, it was Freud's remarkable gift to be so acutely and yet playfully attentive to what language could do, express, and perform. In other words, again referencing Goldschmidt, Everything was already hidden in German, and it was simply the fact that Freud allowed himself to be seduced by this language that enabled him to discover the language's linguistic secrets that had already always been hidden in it all along.
Mm-hmm. I still agree with that.
In fact, you admire the person who wrote it, right? As do I, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I was speaking of you, but yes, Goldschmidt too.
No, I'm Goldschmidt. I this is not
oh,
me.
Oh, yeah. Okay. But there is an equally lovely metaphor that's yours. And that is the metaphor of the bellboy. And it's a wonderful example for us to close our conversation, because it offers your reflections on your life's journey. Do you want to share with the listener the bellboy image and what it has meant to you?
Oh, the bellboy image, yeah. Well, because I've always been, you know, fascinated by Freud's idea of Nachträglichkeit, the retroactive, Strakey, unfortunately, just initially translated it as deferred action. And that until I think Lacan and Laplanche sort of really got into the language of what it meant and remained deferred action. And it just, that's only half of the meaning of it. Because in German, there is nachtragen and nachträglich. That's another difficulty. Nachträglich, that's only 2 points over the A, actually means resentful. Nachtragend means that you carry, and this is where I think of the bellboy, you carry something behind. Yeah? Something that you might have forgotten. You know, usually when you go into a hotel, right, what's the custom is you come and you arrive in your room, they let you first look at the room, and then the bellboy comes afterwards with your luggage and sort of carries behind you what you might have left behind. So that's the very literal translation of Nachträglichkeit. And sometimes
you've applied that to
and
your story.
You can be resentful about that too, because he doesn't come on time, or he might have mixed up the suitcases or whatever. So it plays even within the German language between it is retrospectively, it is behind and gives it new meaning. But there's also always the possibility that it can cause some sort of resentment.
And you've used that to represent your life's journey, yeah?
Yeah.
You want to share how it matches up with
Well, as I said to you in the beginning, you know, you begin this journey, you're kind of a little bit maybe blue-eyed and a little naive, and you want to do something because you want to do it. And then, you know, you stop at one point and you're thinking, why did I do this? You know, what motivated me besides and behind all the conscious ideas and plans, and so this, the, you know, as you said, in the, you know, what did I, you know, what did I feel internally I had to repeat what was done by the Germans to the Jews? And I think there was some sort of really unconscious identification that I could only really feel years later. Certainly not at the time I went, but I think it had a lot to do with it.
And you describe that returning to a German home is the bellboy bringing your luggage. It's now time to unpack and possess your past, as opposed to your temporary sojourn in California. Yeah, is that a fair?
Well, it didn't feel temporary. It did not feel temporary.
Right.
There were many years I couldn't even imagine ever leaving the United States. It didn't feel temporary. And I'm not exactly sure the journey is over. I have no idea. Who knows where
I end up. I understand.
But it does, none of it had that finality. It sort of, And it's not, you know, I didn't end up in my home country. I end up in Austria, where in some way I'm a foreigner again. And I guess, you know, once you are a foreigner and you have that foreignness in you, you never feel like a native anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's like being an analyst. We're always in the real moment and outside the real moment.
Well, as Joyce McDougall said, didn't she say it? You're like a
An immigrant. Yeah.
An immigrant with a tourist visa. Right, I love that.
Just promising me one thing, Jean, that if your travels continue, that you let me know and we will have another conversation about your journey, wherever it may take you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for spending this time with us. You've shed light on many things that will be new for, certainly has been new for me, and will be new for many of our listeners. And I think we will look at each of our own analytic journeys, though they may not be as geographically widespread as yours, but we will look at it with the fresh eyes of an outsider, borrowing your eyes, and we'll be better off for it. And hopefully our clinical work will as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Avi.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.